Today's Teisho will be on case 51 in the Heikigan Roku, the Piyen Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 51 is entitled Seppo's What Is This? Engo's Introduction. If you have the slightest choice of right and wrong, you will fall into confusion of mind. If you are not caught up in the ranks, there will be no groping in the dark. Tell me, which is advisable, letting go or holding fast? At this point, if you deal in terms of concepts and remain attached to sophisticated thinking, you are a ghost clinging to weeds and bushes. Even if you become innocent of such vulgarity, you are still thousands of miles away from your homeland. Do you understand? If not, just study the present koan. See the following. Main subject. When Seppo was living in his hermitage, two monks came to pay their respects. As Seppo saw them coming, he pushed open the gate and, presenting himself to them, said, "What is this?" The monks also said, "What is this?" Seppo lowered his head and returned to his cottage. Later, the monks came to Ganto, who said, "Where are you from?" The monks answered, "We have come from south of Nanrei Mountains." Ganto said, "Have you ever been to see Seppo?" The monks said, "Yes, we have been to see him." Ganto said, "What did he say to you?" The monks related the whole story. Ganto said, "Alas, I regret that I did not tell him the last word when I was with him. If I had done so, no one in the world could have pretended to outdo him." At the end of the summer session, the monks repeated the story and asked Ganto for instruction. Ganto said, "Why didn't you ask earlier?" The monk said, "We had a hard time struggling with this koan." Ganto said, "Seppo came to life in the same way that I did, but he does not die in the same way that I do. If you want to know the last word, I'll simply tell you, this. Secho's verse, the last word, let me tell you, light and darkness intermingled, living in the same way, You all know, dying in different ways beyond telling, absolutely beyond telling. Buddha and Dharma only nod to themselves, east, west, north, and south, homeward let us go, late at night, seeing the snow on the thousand peaks." Thank you very much for coming to practice Zen this morning. this koan involves two very famous Zen masters, Nanto and Seppo and Ganto. There are many koans that involve both of them. They were both students of the same teacher and had many students in the Tang Dynasty. This koan is a really interesting koan. When I was training in Seattle with Genki Roshi, when I first started training there, we would come into the Zen house, this house we were renting at the time for a gathering for meditation. And there was a room, sort of a foyer type room, as you came through the main door before you went into the hallway and then into the living room of the house, which we had turned into a zendo. And when you came through the door and you entered the foyer, people understood that they should take off their shoes and leave them there. And so, you know, when I first started going to the Zen house in Seattle, I would come in and I'd usually be right on the edge of being late. So I would take off my shoes and I would toss them down into the pile of shoes that was in that room. So there was just like a jumble of shoes and socks. And I would take my shoes off and sort of toss them down and run into the Zendo before it was time to start reciting the morning sutras. And then after the morning events were over, we would all come out and there'd be a big line waiting to get to the shoes, and there were pegs for coats as well. But you'd have to sift through all of these shoes. You know, you'd have to pick through the shoes and try to find your shoes in the jumble. And this went on and on for a while. And then one day, we were in the Zendo waiting, and Genki Roshi was late, which was quite uncharacteristic of our teacher. And then he came in, and we went through the sutra recitation, and then we had zazen, etc. And then we all got up to leave, and when we went into that room, all of our shoes were neatly aligned along the wall or in rows. Matching shoes, neatly aligned, socks like folded on the shoes, the whole room was like that. It was a lesson that was repeated many times. You know, so when we would go to Sesshin, same thing, you know, we would all have our sandals or our flip-flops. And before we came into the building, we'd all toss them down. And Genki would, really annoy Genki if they weren't placed neatly together against the wall. And Genki would say, you are your shoes. You know, you are your shoes. Don't you understand that you are these shoes? And I never understood that. I did not understand that. You know, I thought that was crazy, you know. I mean, you know, I felt this way. You know, we were here to meditate. And we were here to pursue enlightenment. You know, who cares about the goddamn shoes, you know? It's like, we have bigger fish to fry than this. You know, why worry about the shoes? You know, for a long time, I felt this was just some strange quirk of Japanese culture, you know. Genki Roshi once, we were once visited by a monk who was from Genki Roshi's temple, Ryutakuji. And the monk came to sit with us, and Genki Roshi, later, when the monk left, was quite disapproving of him. And I asked him, I said, well, what was wrong with the guy? And Genki Roshi let me know that his sandals were a disgrace. You know, in Japan, monks wear a certain kind of sandal. And this monk's sandals were sort of broken down and rather dirty. And Genki Roshi sort of wrote him off because of his sandals. And I just thought, again, I thought, I don't know what it is about Genki Roshi and shoes, you know, but give the guy a break, right? Later, I saw Genki Roshi, in our community, many people who had been practicing for a long time had Jukai ceremony. A couple people... I really haven't held Jukai until quite recently, Jukai ceremonies until quite recently. I changed my mind about this. And in the last couple of years, people who have been practicing here for a certain number of years have had the option of taking Jukai, taking a Dharma name, and then receiving what's called a Raksu. And a Raksu is like a little robe that hangs off your neck. It usually goes down about to your midriff, your waist. And it's a little tiny version of a robe. And it's worn around your neck. And in Japan, especially Rinzai monks wear this rakusu. And so most of the people in our group had taken a rakusu. And, you know, we wore them all the time. We wore them when we sat, but we also wore them when we went in to eat our meals. And Genki Roshi was an extremely kindly person. You know, it's many Zen teachers are famous for being very fierce with their students, but Genki was always very kind. But I did see him once pull a student over and say to him privately, not in public. He said, "Look at your raksu. It's a disgrace." And indeed, the guy had like soup stains on his raksu. And Genki Roshi said, "Don't you know this is who you are?" See, don't you know this is who you are? Yeah, I still didn't get it. It took me a long time to get it. You know, I thought, well, look, it's just a raksu, right? It's just cloth. It's just cloth, you know. We all know that a person can be a wonderful person and wear maybe a dirty shirt or an old shirt that's a little torn, right? So we would say, you know, don't judge a book by its cover, right? That's a famous Western saying. Don't judge a book by its cover. You know, so somebody, you might meet somebody who, you know, isn't very, you know, his shirt might be a little wrinkled or, you know, maybe a button is missing. You wouldn't necessarily write him off, right? You know, people get in a hurry. You know, if you come into my office, I'm glad Genki Roshi has not seen my office, you know, because he would probably be upset. You know, my desk can get pretty messy. And I would say, you know, cut me some slack. I'm busy, right? I've got a lot going on. You know, I'll clean it up. You know, give me a minute. You know, give me a break. You know, so there is something to this idea that, you know, don't judge a book by its cover. You know, Genki Roshi sort of judged that monk by his sandals. You know, it just seemed rectitude, right? You know, why are you giving this monk such a hard time? Okay, he got some soup on his raksu. Big deal, right? It's just a raksu. It took me a long time to realize that this might not be true. You know, I might be wrong about this. That maybe Genki Roshi was on to something. We definitely imagine ourselves as separate from the world around us, you know? We definitely think that way. We definitely see ourselves as apart from the things that we say that happen to us, right? You know, you know, if you go to work and, you know, maybe there's a lot of tension in your office, you know, you might close the door and you might say, that's their problem, right? That's their problem. You know, that's not me. I'm not going to get into a fight with them. I'm not going to get involved. That's not me. You know, so when we think about ourselves, very often we think of ourselves as separate from what's happening around us, right? We're separate. I'm not my shoes. I'm not my shirt, you know. And as a matter of fact, I'm not, you know, if If my administrative assistant is arguing with my secretary, I'm not my administrative assistant, and I'm not my secretary. I'm not going to get in it with them. I'm not going to take sides. I'm going to close the door and be by myself, right? So you know, that's kind of how we think. And yet, very strange thing happens as you get older. You know, I across the 60, the 60 year mark, right? And it definitely has changed many things. You know, I will find myself sometimes remembering events that happened to me, 55 years ago. You know, and I can remember my kindergarten classroom. I really can. I can remember that there was a place to hang up our coats. I can almost remember I probably can't really remember, but I feel like I can remember, you know, the layout of the room. There was a playground, you know, in the back of the, we would exit through the back of the classroom, and we could go right out onto the playground. And I remember that we all used to bring towels. And we used to, we had like a nap time during the middle of the day, after lunch, I think it was. You know, we would all have to spread our towels out on the ground and lie on the towels. And our teacher would go around and she'd say, I want to make sure you're really relaxed. You know, your fingers have to be curved. So I'll look at your fingers to make sure they're curved and they're curling rather, not straight out. Because if they're curling, you're relaxed. And we just lie there, I think, for I don't know how long, 10 minutes or something, until we were a little rested. And, you know, I can remember we used to put oilcloth on the tables before we would do finger painting. You know, and for finger painting, we had this paper that was very shiny and smooth on one side. And you put the paint on there, and then you can really smear the paint around with no resistance. It was wonderful. So, you know, just the other day I was remembering all that, you know, and I remember, my good friend Mark Miller, who was in the same class with me, and there was another kid whose name I can't remember his last name, but his name was Freddie, and we were like the Three Musketeers, you know, we always hung out together. You know, I can remember other things like that too, you know, I can remember the apartment we lived in Baltimore when I was going to that school. I can remember, you know, which apartment it was. I can sort of visualize in my mind. I can remember who our neighbors were. You know, on the right hand of our apartment, if you're facing the apartment, on the right hand was Dr. Worsley. He was our family physician. He lived in the same apartment complex. And on the left hand side was Mr. Morrissey, who was an engineer for Lockheed Martin. And I used to play with his daughters, Lynn Ann and Carrie. You know, I can remember all this. You know, and if I think back on all of those things, you know, I say, yeah, but where was I? You know, okay, I was in kindergarten, and I can remember Mark Miller and Freddie, the tablecloth. I can remember lying down on the ground. I can remember Mrs. Stoddard, our teacher, you know, who was very tall with black hair, Mrs. Stoddard. I can remember the smell of the paste we used to use. You know, we used to use this paste to glue things, which was very sweet. It was like peppermint paste. You could actually eat the paste. It was made out of flour. I can remember, but where was I? You know, the thing is, you know, if I ask where I was, you know, all I can remember is the schoolroom, the students, the paste. I can remember the tablecloth and so on. You know, if I try to remember who I was or what I was back then, I can remember my apartment. You know, I can remember Dr. Worsley. I can remember, I can't find anything else when I look back. They can't find the me. I mean, I maybe looked in the mirror. But if you say, you know, who was I? What was I? What was I? You know, when you look back, you realize, you know, what was my life? Who am I? I was the classroom. I was the paste. I was the tablecloth. See, there isn't something else there that's the me. You know, my feeling is now, you know, when I say, what was my life, it's all of those things. It was the apartment. It was seeing Dr. Worsley come home. It was playing with Lynn Ann. It was playing with Carrie and playing with Ann, Dr. Worsley's daughter. You know, that's it. That was my life in Baltimore. You know, a little later, I went to a different school, you know, and, you know, my father was in the service. You know, he was in the military, and so we often traveled, you know. And my father would pull us out of school in the middle of the school year, and we'd have to go to a completely different place. So, you know, we might be like in the second grade. I might be in the second grade in San Diego, and then halfway through the school year, we moved to Virginia. And I'm in a school in Yorktown, Virginia, and I have to learn all these new people's names, and all my old friends are gone, you know. And, you know, after a while, you stop making friends, almost, because you realize, you know, I'm going to make these friends, and then they're going to be gone. So, you know, you're at this school, and you think, well, these people are not me, right? This school is not me. I'm in the school, but it's not really who I am, you know. So I was in, there was a San Diego elementary school. I can't remember the name of it, where I went for a while. Then I was at Magruder Elementary School in Yorktown, Virginia, you know. Those are just places I was. It wasn't who I really was. But when you look back, you realize, you know, that was me. That was my life. It was Magruder Elementary School. It was, you know, Bobby Westbrook in the third grade. It was Mrs. Latta, you know. As we're going forward through life, you know, we feel separate from everything around us. You know, separate from everything around us, or we can. You know, it's almost like I'm fascinated by superheroes, you know. You know, all the superheroes, or almost all the superheroes, have a private identity, right? So, you know, Superman is really Clark Kent. Clark Kent is Superman, right? So the message is, you know, in public you're Superman, but privately you're someone else. Batman is Bruce Wayne. You know, publicly he's Batman, but privately he's the real self is not publicly, no, it's not publicly present. It's hidden inside, you know. You know, this is really like a reflection of the way we see the world. You know, we have a public, identity. You know, we go to school, but school's not who we really are. You know, we associate with people, but they're not who we really are. There's always this sense that I am here, but I'm not really here. You know, I'm somewhere else. I'm somewhere inside my head. I'm somewhere else. Somewhere else. Where is that, right? This is, I think, a little game we play with ourselves. But, you know, when you look back over your life, there's nothing there but the places you were and the people you knew and the things you did. You know, so, you know, I can remember the first time I rode a horse. I've only been on a horse a couple times. But I remember riding a horse and just being amazed and almost falling off about five times. You know, I could say, well, I'm not really the person, you know, the horse is not me. You know, riding the horse is not who I really am. You know, I'm somewhere else. But actually, you know, that was me at that moment. You know, so I think we play a game with ourselves all the time. You know, we're constantly going through life saying, I am not really here, wherever we happen to be. Or, I'm hanging out with these people, but they're not who I really am.
See, they're not who I really am. But actually, you know, they're who you really are. You know, that's who you. Your life is who you really are. You know, so you know, in a way, I think Genki Roshi was much more right than I realized. You know, this boundary that we create, this imaginary boundary between ourself and the world, is a kind of a mental game we play. But maybe we do it to protect ourselves, right? I mean, we create that boundary. We say, I'm not really here. This is not really me. As maybe it's a defense mechanism, you know. But it's really an illusion, and it prevents us, I think, from really living a different way, a better way. You know, when we sit down on the cushion, you know, and we begin to do meditation, you know, we discover something if we persist in it, you know. So, if you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath, and you do this with great regularity, eventually you will enter a state we call samadhi. And in samadhi, you know, there is the sort of thinking interior subject kind of disappears. So there are many fewer thoughts, and your attention is, you're 90% present with the object of your attention. So if you're watching your breath, you know, you're, instead of having thoughts and watch your breath, the thoughts begin to recede and you're just present with your breath. You're just present with your breath, and you come back to the breath, and you come back to the breath, and little by little, the thoughts continue to recede, and you begin to feel this sense of being connected to your breath, connected to your breath. You know, and when you're in really deep samadhi, you know, we could say you become one with your breath. But actually, you were always one with your breath. You know, what you're doing is you stop playing the game of separating yourself from what you are at this moment, you know. If you continue to practice Zen and you can enter that state of samadhi fairly often and fairly deeply. In our tradition, the teacher will ask you to meditate on what we call mu, or emptiness. You know, and if you watch your mind long enough, you know, you're calling mu, you'll begin to notice that at the end of there is a kind of blankness in your field of attention that keeps recurring. You know, you hear the sound, I talked about this last time, you hear the sound of the fan overhead, and then you realize your mind is blank. And then you feel maybe some discomfort in your leg, and you realize your mind is blank. And if you begin to practice this kind of emptiness meditation long enough, you know, you will get to a place where that experience of blankness is very deep and very sustained, you know. And eventually, you know, you realize, you know, to put it one, you could put it this way, you know, at the core of your consciousness, there is just this blankness, just this emptiness, you know. Now, at first, you know, people don't know what to make of this. It's odd that there's this blankness when you focus on calling mu, on your koan. But you know, eventually, you know, you begin to realize, you know, this blankness is like the core of your being, you know. And if you stay in this blankness long enough, if you keep going back there, you know, you begin to interact with the world in a very different way. You know, it's quite common for people who have been meditating for a while to have experiences where they feel deeply connected with the things around them, right? You know, so, a common experience is to say, finish sitting here in the Zendo one night and walk outside, and suddenly you notice the moon overhead. You know, a number of days ago, you know, the moon was absolutely huge in the sky. And a number of us were walking out of the Zendo, and we looked up, and there was that enormous moon, right, sort of hazy on that particular night. You know, and, you know, when you're in your ordinary consciousness, you're playing the game of being separate from the things around you. But when you are in deep samadhi, it's like you look up and you there's nothing but the moon in your consciousness. You are the moon. Right? You are the moon. The moon is who you really are at that moment. And if you look for yourself, there's no other self but that moon at that moment. You know, so in our tradition, in Zen, we would say this is actually a deep experience of fundamental reality. You know, the fantasy is that we're separate from the world around us. You know? But when we are cultivating mushin, cultivating samadhi, and cultivating empty mind, and we get off the cushion, we experience the world as that we stop constructing that distance between ourselves and the world, and we experience the world as who we really are. You know? And at first, this is really like a very cool and interesting experience, right? And it'll happen to you many times, you know. I remember once we had a sesshin, and on the way home from in Seattle, at the Seattle Zen Center. And I was riding home. I can't remember who I was riding home with. Maybe it was a Webb sensei. And he stopped at like a quick check. We were driving home from the sesshin, and he stopped at a quick check and said, "Why don't you wait here? I just have to run in, and I'm going to get a cup of coffee." And while I was sitting in the car, it took him a while. I turned on the radio, and it was just playing some kind of pop music, sort of bubblegummy pop music. But I could have been listening to Beethoven. It was just so beautiful. I felt so deeply moved, right? You could say, well, that's absurd. You know, is this, you know, top 40 type music? But you know, I was the music. And when you are the music, you know, those questions of quality, you realize are very artificial. I was 100%. That music, and it actually just made me want to weep. It was so moving, you know. We live, the Zen view is that we live in a very artificial way. We live imagining ourselves as not being present in our own life. And eventually this becomes a deeply maintained habit. You know, it becomes harder and harder to feel connected to the world around us, even though there's nothing to us except the world around us. You know, many people, as they get older, struggle with depression and boredom. And this is really quite common. People in their late 60s, 70s, struggle with depression and boredom. And man, I was reading just something the other day about how many of them report being bored all the time. And I think this is really, this sense of boredom is produced by constantly separating yourself from the world around you. You know, I really would say that if you practice Zazen, you will never be bored. The boredom disappears from your world. Something is always happening. You know, people who are bored have learned how to dissociate themselves so powerfully that they can't get out of it, you know. When I was a little boy, there was a very famous actor. His name was George Saunders. But he was like a very respected actor. And when he was like in his late 60s, he committed suicide. And on his suicide letter, he said, "I'm just too bored," right? But it makes perfect sense. You know, we are constantly closing the world off from ourselves, you know. So basically, you know, Genki Roshi, there was really great wisdom in what Genki Roshi was trying to do, you know, because, you know, once you stop separating yourself from the world, your relationship to the world really changes. You know, we go through life practicing separation. We go through life saying, "I'm not present here. This is not who I really am," right? And so, you know, our relationship to the world is very careless and disrespectful and uncompassionate, right? But if you practice Zen for a long time, your relationship to the world really changes. You know, you begin to have this attitude of caring for the world around you. You know, everything, you know, is your true self. Everything is your true self. So, you know, you begin to take care of everything as though it were your true self, you know. And at first, you know, in Zen training, this is only, this is a little bit artificial. You know, so, you know, if you're a trainee, a monk in training, you know, you probably haven't reached the level of deep samadhi where you begin to feel connected to the world around you. But you learn how to be careful with your shoes and put them against the wall in a mindful way, in a respectful way. And you're cultivating a habit of caring for the world around you, right? Eventually, you know, at first it's a kind of an artificial gesture. Putting your shoes down neatly seems a little fussy. But, you know, eventually, you know, you realize these shoes are Buddha. You know, these shoes are Buddha. You know, I walk on these shoes. These shoes carry me through my day. You know, somebody spent hours and hours making these shoes. You know, in some Zen traditions, when people eat, before they eat, they recite, you know, 1,000 labors have brought us this food. You know, Genki Roshi's Dharma brother was a person named Soen Nakagawa Roshi, who is a very famous poet. He's really one of the most famous haiku poets in the 20th century in Japan. And Soen Roshi, before he was a Roshi, Genki Roshi told me that you know, they would all be eating in the temple, and they would be reciting the sutras for the food. And when the recitation was over and people started eating, he said a couple times he looked over and Soen Roshi was staring at his rice and tears were going down his face. Now you could say that's very strange behavior, but I would actually say that's a very deeply awakened person. You know, everything is my true self. Everything is my true self. You know, to be one with the rice, to be one with your shoes, to be one with the people around you. You know, how often are we with people and we aren't really with them, you know? And then they're gone, right? I mean, you know, my sister and my mother had a very tense relationship. Many mothers and daughters have, you know, tense relationships. And, you know, now that my mother has passed away, you know, sometimes my sister will say, "I miss Mom so much." And I'm sure she's well aware of how many times, you know, she was with Mother, but not with Mother, right? Not there. Her body was there, but she wasn't there, right? You know, when you look back at your life, you realize that all of those moments where you weren't there is who you really are, You aren't anything other than those moments. So, you know, you begin to have a different attitude towards the world. You know, this world is my body. My body is my responsibility. I will care for my body. You know, I will take care of it. I will protect it. You know. So you know, this attitude towards the world is really important. I don't have to point out that, you know, our way of life is almost, it's like breathtakingly destructive, right? I mean, you know, I definitely think that we are going to have an environmental crisis, or we're already in one. And many people become deeply alarmed about this, but, you know, there are many people who don't feel that they really are here. It's like, you know, if all the bees die, you know, it would be inconvenient if we have to use mechanical bees to pollinate our plants, and scientists are working on mechanical bees, but, you know, people who think that way are not present in their own life. You know, they're here in the world, but it's not who they really are. And that mentality is, you know, is a very destructive mentality. So, you know, I want to say that it's only taken me 50 years, but I really understand now what Genki Roshi was trying to tell us about putting our shoes carefully next to the wall, about keeping our rakusu clean, right? Caring for others, caring for the world, right? You can say, well, yeah, but, you know, environmental crisis is a big issue. My shoes, the world will be okay if I don't take care of my shoes, but that mentality, you know, is really maybe misplaced, right? You know, your world right now might just be your shoes. Tomorrow it might be the Amazon forest, you know, but if you take care of your world right now, you're cultivating a mind, the proper kind of mind, right? There's another aspect of this too, you know. I, like everybody, like at least half the country, you know, I read the newspaper in the morning and I read my latest Trump story. And I truly believe that he is mentally ill. I mean, personally, I think he is, there's no question that Donald Trump is mentally ill. And that he has some kind of a narcissistic personality disorder and may even be suffering from, like, early dementia or something like that, you know. I naturally want to say to myself, I am not Donald Trump, right? But you know, actually, Donald Trump is who I really am. Yes, it's true. It's who you really are too. This is our life. You know, when you look back on this moment, you are not anything other than all the things that are in your life right now, you know. So Donald Trump is a part of who you are, you know. And how we decide to deal with that is really important. I mean, I think it's important for people to understand that Donald Trump is who they really are. That there's a little Trump in each of us, really and truly, even though we look at him and we're appalled. You know, I would imagine that all of us have had our Donald Trump moments. You know, all of us can be very self-absorbed. Me too. You know, all of us can be very self-absorbed, petty, childish, whiny, you know, revengeful. It sounds familiar. You know, I think one of the ways in which we take responsibility for the world, which is ourself, is to practice Zazen. You know, there is definitely a Trump in me. You know, there is definitely a Hitler in me. You know, those things are really there. We say, no, no, not in me. You know, they're not part of me. No, no, they're a part of everything that is part of me, you see. So, you know, I think part of Zen practice has a kind of ethical dimension. You know, it's when you sit down on the cushion, yes, you're relaxing, you're cultivating an enlightened mind. It's lovely to be in samadhi. But you're also, you know, working on yourself. This is another kind of self-care or world protection activity, right? You know, one of the reasons we sit is because, you know, because there is a Trump inside of all of us. There is a Hitler inside of all of us. And we have to deal with that, you know, every day. You have to deal with the Trump in you, the Hitler in you, every day. And, you know, if you're a Zen Buddhist, the way you deal with that is by sitting on the cushion and going into deep mushin and purifying body, heart, and mind, dealing with your fears, dealing with your anger, dealing with your insecurity. You know, the basic teaching of Buddhism is that all people are fundamentally good. That's definitely so. Even Trump is fundamentally good. But Donald Trump is terribly screwed up, and so indeed are most people to some degree. You know, so taking responsibility for taking a responsibility for the welfare of the world, the whole world is your work. That's your task. And the way we start to do, yes, you can fly to the Amazon and maybe you can sign a petition to do this and that, but you first have to deal with the Trump in yourself. You first have to deal with the Hitler in yourself, yes? So, you know, sitting on the cushion every day and working through our obstacles is like a moral imperative. This is taking care of the world, starting with the Trump in ourselves. You know, I think people are a little bit naive about how screwed up people can be, even though we have Trump running the country. You know, we're a little bit naive about who we really are. You know, we definitely need to practice cleaning up, straightening the shoes in our mind if we don't want to become a Donald Trump. You know, at some point in his life, Trump wasn't what he is now. He might have been a much better person who was careless and self-absorbed. And flash forward 40 years and you get a monster. But monsters are made one step at a time. When Seppo was living in his hermitage, two monks came to pay their respects. As Seppo saw them coming, he pushed open the gate and presented himself before them and said, "What is this?" The monks said, "What?" They didn't have an answer. They imitated him. They said, "What is this?" Seppo lowered his head and returned to his cottage. Later, the monks came to Ganto, who said, "Where are you from?" The monks answered, "We have come from south of the Nanrei Mountains." Ganto said, "Did you get to see Seppo, my old Dharma brother?" The monks said, "Yes, we have been to see him." Ganto said, "What did he say to you?" The monks related the story. Ganto said, "Alas, I regret that I did not tell him the last word when I was with him. If I had done so, no one in the whole world could have pretended to outdo him." So he's trying to get the monks to meditate. He's throwing smoke, blowing smoke in their eyes, so they will be confused and sit down on the cushion. At the end of the summer session, the monks repeated the story and asked Ganto for his instruction. They finally come back to him and said, "What did you mean?" And Ganto said, "Why didn't you ask earlier?" The monks said, "We've had a hard time with this koan." Ganto said, "Seppo came to life in the same way that I did, but he did not die in the same way that I do. If you want to know the last word, I'll simply tell you, you are this. You are this."